So, welcome back to the Tree Planters Podcast. Your regular hosts, Margaret and Adam, have allowed us, I'm Kelly and I'm with Blythe today, to do a little bit of a podcast takeover for the months of July and August. Today, we really want to talk to you about the importance of youth participation in local advocacy. As you know, youth are already leading the movement for climate justice, but there's still some barriers to talk about. Organizations, governments, and adults in general need to do a much better job at supporting youth. Whether this means using whatever capacity you can to support youth-led initiatives, or work to make your organizations, groups, and networks more accessible and welcoming for youth, we're going to chat today about youth participation in community initiatives and local politics. So I'm Kelly. I'm working with SCGC for the summer as their youth engagement lead.
And I'm Blythe, working with SCGC as their environmental youth advocacy intern.
And so we're taking over the podcast to be a younger voice for the community. So I think there's still a lot of the idea that youth participation means, you know, asking for input or consulting youth on something like a project rather than like meaningful participation and actually giving them the decision-making power. So obviously we need to see more participatory decision-making models, I think, when talking about youth involvement. We're seeing more of that in the field of academic research with participatory action research, especially with marginalized youth, but we're not seeing a lot of that in our communities.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And then also, like you said, you know, adult organizations are typically just looking to youth to sort of check out what they already have, support their organizations. And I think it's really important that we start allowing youth and giving youth space to create their own initiatives that are taken just as seriously as the adult initiatives are.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in so many things, whether it's, you know, some kind of, you know, nonprofit or with government, whatever it is, we see a lot of, you know, there's the organization proper, and then there's like the youth division or like the youth representative or something. And it's a way to give youth a voice, but it's also kind of a second tier part of the organization, you know? So like you were saying, legitimizing youth-led organizations themselves and in other, you know, regular, you know, adult-run organizations, just allowing youth in there and not making them the youth position, but just giving them that decision-making power and on an equal standing.
Yeah. I know that high school students, like personally, I'm 16, I'm going into grade 11, so I still have a few years of high school left. Myself and my classmates, you know, in our science classes, in our extracurriculars, in the within the environmental nonprofits that we're already a part of, the youth are ones that are generating pretty, you know, innovative and creative ideas that are specifically tailored to sort of the youth experience in growing up during the climate crisis. While, you know, obviously it's stressful and it's a very unique experience for youth of today, it allows us to have a certain special viewpoint on the whole problem that adults may not have. And so I think it's really important that youth are sort of brought to the same level, maybe not the same level in, you know, running an organization, doing finances, because obviously we don't have those skills that you learn just later in life, but you can't discredit youth skills in, you know, brainstorming and getting people excited and coming up with new and fresh ideas that I think is really important in the fight against climate change and just in activism in general, because organizations are constantly looking for new ways to engage public, engage different demographics that they haven't reached yet. And I think youth can be really important in sort of like unlocking that.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. Yeah, like you said, that unique perspective that youth bring, you know, it's they are more creative, but it's not just that younger people are inherently more creative. It's that they haven't been socialized into all of this very limited and narrow thinking that older people have had more time being socialized
into. We're not exactly especially as formal.
Exactly. There's less of that, you know, that's social etiquette. I don't know if we can swear in this. there's a lot of that just... that social etiquette and like that more bureaucratic professionalism that adults get caught up in sometimes. So when it turns into just finding ways to just be polite or find excuses to like walk circles around the problem. Whereas youth are like, no, this is the problem. Let's actually just address this and just talk about it out in the open. And like you said, you know, younger people we're the first generation that's growing up in this era when all of the impacts of climate change are actually being lived through.
Exactly. It's not just like
we've been seeing
speculation and like environmental trends that will happen in the future. Like we can see even what's happening in Ontario with like wildfires and, you know, all the changes in temperature and our weather and et cetera. Like we can actually see the effects of climate change, whereas in the past it was just, oh, this could happen in the future if we don't act now. Like now we can actually see it.
Exactly. Yeah, like you said, in the past, you know, we've known about, scientists and others have known about all of this for decades and have been warning, you know, governments for decades about this. But you know, the impacts, and obviously the Global South has been feeling the impacts much longer and much more severely. But I think another thing that youth bring is that with social media and that propensity for more informal and more participatory ways of communicating and organizing and everything else, really, we're seeing that sharing of experiences. So we're seeing...
Yeah.
So many, you know, young activists from other countries as well, joining in raising the alarm. And I think more young people from the North, from, you know, Canada and other countries are a lot more empathetic to that and actually recognize those experiences as well. Because while we, you know, aren't feeling... We're not going to feel the worst impacts here in Ontario and much of the global North and you know, especially the middle class white people in the global North. You know, young people do have more in common with the rest of the planet who's disproportionately feeling this, because the adults here aren't going to live through the worst of this, whereas we're going to live through a lot more than they ever will. And I think, yeah, we're just more empathetic to what's going on in the rest of the world as well.
Yeah. And I mean, we've, like I've already said, like we've grown up with these problems. It's kind of become a norm in our lives. You know, in school, we were taught about it. We were taught that we're going to be the ones that are going to have to deal with it. So we better get, you know, we better get working to fix it. And then as well, like you said, with social media, I feel like the youth today, just because, you know, generations in the past, we didn't have that tool, that sort of global connection that it brings. On the Instagram pages of myself and my peers, it is extremely common to see someone posting on their story about climate effects that are being felt in, you know, Indonesia, in the Philippines, the Global South that you were talking about. It's not just what's going on in Canada, especially since we aren't feeling the most severe effects of climate change as of yet. They haven't reached us, but we are definitely seeing more of a global perspective and more of a global unity when it comes to today's youth regarding climate issues and even just social justice issues in general. Like with the movements that were happening last summer in the States, like that wasn't just a state's problem. Everyone in Canada, everyone in Europe, so many people were talking about it. And that's just because of what things like social media can bring. So there's definitely more of a global perspective that youth have now at this age versus, you know, other generations in like a youth sort of age. And I think that's another really important sort of skill that youth can bring to discussions about improving communities that they're living in and just improving worldwide.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And of course, social media, you know, while that is, you know, a bit of a double-edged sword because there are mm-hmm. some problematic aspects of it, but it's also been, it has so much potential to be a more democratizing tool, because although they're private platforms that collect and sell our data for profit, you know, youth have been able to use social media and other similar tools to make a more informal politics. Like we're seeing, there's academic research on this as well. There's literature on this, that young people are obviously so disillusioned with formal politics, with election cycles and politicians. Yeah. There's such a disconnect there because we're sick of all of the games and all of it being just for show, and there's just inauthenticity. We need better than that. So youth are gravitating towards more informal forms of politics, the grassroots organizing, the community level work, getting involved in initiatives rather than formal politics, which I think is really important because while voting is super important, you know, getting involved in the informal politics is actually that's a deeper kind of democracy. So I think the fact that youth are moving towards that, while a lot of people use that argument that, you know, youth don't vote as much as an argument, a really ageist argument against youth, I think it actually shows that, you know, we're sick of all of the games and the corruption and everything wrong with formal politics, and we're actually moving towards creating a more participatory democratic society that has more just collective and collaborative work and a different way of living, that brings that decision making and that group work into all parts of our lives. And I think that's really something hopeful. That's a hopeful trend that we're seeing. And you know, that brings us to another thing that I know we wanted to talk about today. You know, there's this idea that, you know, youth are the future and we need to, you know, prepare them for the real world, which is completely which is nonsense, because while youth obviously are going to be the ones living, you know, in the future with these consequences of the decisions being made today, obviously youth are already living in the present and already living in the real world. You know, we see that, you know, in school a lot, right? It's not like people, you know, live in a vacuum. We see that in schools where it's like youth are expected to just not bring any of their lived experiences or identities or ideas or fears or anything into the classroom. Once they come into the classroom, they're like just a mind who learns whatever the curriculum says they're supposed to learn. But obviously they exist outside of school. It's not like when they turn 18 or 25 or whatever constructed idea of adulthood we want to use.
What you were talking about with politics and how youth are sort of gravitating towards more grassroots initiatives, less formal politics, I agree with that. But then also, when youth are engaging in formal politics, it is quite unlike anything I think people have sort of seen before, with how the youth are treating their local politicians, even provincial and federal politicians, especially again on social media. Because you see on apps like Instagram and specifically TikTok, once politicians have gotten on TikTok, if you look at the comments, the youth, whether it is a good or bad thing, we are talking to them as if we are sitting next to them in class or they are part of our friend group circle. There isn't as much formality and there isn't as much as a power difference sort of when you're on a platform like TikTok, because I mean, everyone's using the same app. Everyone has the freedom to post the same things. And so looking at the comments of some of the posts of, you know, formal politicians, the way that youth are starting to engage with their politicians and starting to talk to them, especially behind a screen, it's much less formal and I feel like we are a lot less intimidated. And that could also have just been brought by, you know, it's a lot easier that we're not talking to them face to face. We can do it behind a screen, which means that we can actually, you know, share our opinions and collect our thoughts and articulate ourselves properly, which I know in formal spaces, it can be hard for youth to do that sometimes just because of a lack of speaking experience and a lack of dealing with politics and whatnot. So I think that on every level of government, whether it's municipal, provincial, or federal, technology has given youth sort of a way to equalize some of the previous power dynamics that were sort of stifling their voices, because it, you know, it's giving us more time to prepare our thoughts. It's creating a community of support that we might not have had because perhaps there aren't as many youth interested in local politics in our area. But when we can lean on the support of people in other ridings, in other countries, even the global perspective that we're talking on, other provinces, I feel like it's giving us a lot of tools and a lot of the things that youth were lacking beforehand that was making it a bit harder for them to break into politics and sort of force politicians to acknowledge that youth exist and our ideas sort of exist before we turn 18 and before we can formally engage in the voting system and whatnot. And I think that that's pretty interesting to think about.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's, yeah, that's well said. That's, you know, exactly one of these trends that I think we're seeing. Because it's less so youth having to conform to this kind of outdated, as you say, the formality and all of the hoops. As we've learned in some of the work that we're doing, there's so many barriers and so many hoops to jump through to just try to talk to local politicians or contact them, right? But it's more about, you know, less about trying to have us, you know, squeeze into all these hoops and formalities, and more so, you know, letting politicians know in very real ways that it's the politics and the political systems and the way of doing politics that is actually needing to change, not youth, and working towards this more authentic grassroots, you know, community level politics where we can actually get things done instead of wasting time with debates and procedure and all of this, because so many of these issues are urgent. This isn't just, you know, semi-important policies that need to be, you know, administrative things that need to be hashed out. These are really big decisions in a climate emergency that are pretty clear. And I think one other thing that, you know, I think we are seeing a little bit more of is with that move to more, you know, informal politics, we're seeing more local initiatives, more local grassroots organizations, more local advocacy happening. And that brings us, you know, to, I know we wanted to talk about place-based advocacy as well.
Yeah, I have only recently learned the term for place-based advocacy because of my work with the Greenbelt Coalition this summer. But, you know, even when it didn't have a formal name, you could kind of see the growth of place-based advocacy happening, especially, you know, in the Simcoe County area with, I don't know, just with youth and even older organizations, adult-led organizations, focusing on the issues and the developments happening right where we are as a way to engage the public and sort of get people more interested. Because while learning about global issues and things happening overseas is really beneficial, and it can be so motivating, and there's so many great things about it. It's also really important to know what's going on in your own community, because that can serve as its own form of motivation. Because if you're working on a place-based advocacy initiative, when that hopefully goes through, then you'll be able to see the direct impact that you have on your community and the direct impact in your backyard. You're changing your life, you're changing your neighbor's life, etc. And I feel like that can be really important for engaging people and sort of fostering and strengthening a connection with our community. Because while social media and the, like we've been talking about, a whole global perspective, it's so important, especially with really big problems like climate change that do affect the whole world. It's sort of disillusioning sometimes and sort of desensitizing, because while it's great to learn about things happening overseas, you don't feel like it directly impacts you, which can sometimes push people away from getting involved, especially on a local level. So I think it's really important to have a strong connection to your community and the place where you live, because then that will in turn make you more invested in the decisions happening in your community. And I know that later on we're planning on talking about, you know, how much of an impact does municipal policies have on greenhouse gas emissions and fighting climate change on a local level. And I feel like place-based advocacy is a really important start in getting people more involved, especially since municipal impacts can be really large.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that reflects, you know, as you said, learning about international issues and learning about the global scale of the climate crisis, of the climate emergency. You know, that reflects, you know, a trend we see in a globalized world, something that we've been seeing for the past few decades, you know, since kind of the global market happened in the 80s and subsequent decades. We see, you know, even just looking at the school curriculum, like you said, you in high school, you're learning about all of these global issues, these huge, daunting global issues, which are important to know about. But
yeah,
it's also so overwhelming because it's so much more intimidating to take on, you know, a planetary threat, right?
Especially as a youth. Especially since, you know, we don't have, the majority of us are just in high school, you know, starting university. We don't have that undergraduate degree. We don't have the life experience that adults have. And in school, we're being taught great things about, you know, science and maths and literature, but we're also not exactly being taught things about, you know, finance, and we're starting to build more on communication, but kind of just those groundwork skills. A lot of the times youth don't have that. So then when we're tasked to solve these giant problems, sometimes it's like, well, I don't even know how to talk to my local politicians. How am I supposed to help people overseas? How am I supposed to solve these giant problems when I don't even know how to get started in my local community?
Exactly. Which, yeah, it's just why place-based advocacy or place-based education or whatever we want to call it, there's many different terms we could use. But it's that the idea of, you know, moving away from this globalized, you know, worldview that has, you know, dominated from the West and has now dominated, you know, the rest of the world, that has led to us being so disconnected from the places that we live, from our fellow community members, from the land that we live on, from the history of the land that we live on. You know, even the food that we eat and, you know, the technology that we're using, and we don't know where any of this comes from. We just have it delivered. We're so disconnected from, there's an entire process that goes mm-hmm. into making all of this stuff that we just buy. So the importance of place, the importance of place-based advocacy, you know, it grounds the work in what youth are already familiar with, the places that they already know, the, you know, what they already care about, and it builds connections between, you know, the social and environmental issues and the connections between the social and the environmental issues. Mm-hmm. And then the actual lived experiences of youth in the places where they actually live, and kind of builds from the ground up, which is like reforging that connection to place in such a disconnected, globalized world is so crucial, because otherwise we're a little lost. There's a reason why there's, you know, social isolation and alienation and, you know, anxieties are so high right now. It's because we're living in kind of this just individualized world where we don't have connection to anything anymore. Mm-hmm. And we are seeing that in, you know, various, whether it's informal schooling or, you know, informal, you know, community projects, we're seeing that slow shift towards place-based work that looks at, you know, the built and the natural environments, you know, that the people involved actually live in and actually care about, and learning about that, learning about the history of that, learning about, you know, who else even lives in that area, mm-hmm. the land, the ecosystems, the indigenous history, learning about all of these things about place, and then doing something to actually make that place better. You know, not just learning, like not just an education perspective, but merging that with action, right? So we're seeing more action projects that are focused on place, in terms of, you know, the health of rivers and lakes in your area, or revitalization, or art projects, or local history projects, something that brings the community together and addresses climate action and climate adaptation at the same time. Again, merging that, you know, the social perspective and the environmental perspective. And that's another thing that I think youth are doing better than any previous generation, in terms of mainstream environmentalism. Obviously, Indigenous communities have been doing this the entire time.
Yeah.
And in terms of the mainstream movement, we're seeing a lot more of the youth activists, you know, bringing those together and recognizing that housing and, you know, transit and planning and food security and income, like raising the minimum wage, these are all also climate issues, because mm-hmm. what helps with social issues tends to also be the climate action that we need to be making. It's a completely different orientation that addresses everything about the way we live. You know, as Naomi Klein says, we need to change everything, right?
Yeah. And, you know, all the things that you were listing off, like food security, affordable housing, I feel like we've also created the connection between, you know, social issues that we were talking about, how, you know, the fight against climate change and being able to have, you know, an individual impact and creating individual changes is a very white, middle class, living in town, mm-hmm. sort of a privileged idea. Because if you don't have the financial security, or you don't live in a location where you can sort of work on reducing your personal carbon footprint, which obviously is much harder to do in marginalized communities, it's a lot harder to have an individual impact. And when we're taught, you know, going back to this whole not acting as a community, acting in a very individualized basis, it makes it a lot harder for people to create their own changes, which can further push people away from the movement and reduce momentum and things all along those lines. And so it's so important with place-based advocacy to have the connection to the community, because we know and we've seen, especially with recent years where, you know, like you said, mainstream environmentalism has gotten so much more traction, it has been because youth are sort of recognizing that community is the way and collective action is the way to get things done and apply pressure to politicians to listen to the science and, change their policies in accordance to that so that we can actually take steps to fight against climate change and create a more sustainable future.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, youth are recognizing that it's the equity, it's the intersectionality, and it's the collaboration that is mm-hmm. really going to get anything done on anywhere near the scale that they need to be done, which I think is so important and, you know, is why organizations, existing organizations and governments and just adults in general have to do better to support youth in the work that they're doing in whatever yeah. way they can, in whatever way that makes sense for whatever positions they may hold in the community, or even if they're just a parent, right? Just
yeah.
they need to do better at supporting young people. And this is a huge responsibility that schools need to be taking as well, because obviously youth are spending most of their time at school, and most of what you're learning in school is not super relevant. The fact that the entire K-12 curriculum is not centered and grounded in climate adaptation and, you know, teaching the skills that you're going to need to live in the climate future that you're going to live in, from, you know, knowing all of the, you know, the science and the ecology and or ecological literacy to the communication and conflict resolution and the social skills to the creativity and being able to just collaborate and work together, like all of it across the curriculum has to be oriented around this, because this is kind of, this is the defining event. This is the defining feature of the world that you're going to live in for the rest of your life. So schools, exactly. you know, have a huge responsibility to be doing this, and we're not seeing enough. There are some, you know, amazing teachers, classroom teachers who are doing amazing work in this area, but it's not something we're seeing across the board in Ontario at all.
You know, it might be tied to the school system, or it might just be tied to the fact that we're so ingrained in the formal way to do politics and formal way to get engaged in your community, which is you have to be older, you have to have experience. It is pushing some youth away from the whole collective action, from the whole environmentalist movement, because they feel like youth shouldn't have a place here. You know, some people believe that because we don't have the skills and experience that adults have, we are not educated enough on the issues in order to, you know, properly advocate. Therefore, we shouldn't be advocating. It's not a good idea. You know, not all youth are as into environmentalism or as educated or as, you know, experienced. But I feel like that is, again, just another sentiment kind of rooted in that individualism and, you know, you have to be the perfect advocate before you can start. But all youth are concerned about the environment and climate change and are concerned about their futures, no matter how much we try to put it out of our minds and just hope that the adults are going to fix it. It's always there. And part of that community collective action is supporting the youth that are just as anxious, but just haven't been as educated on the subject or aren't as experienced in activism or advocacy, maybe because they're so anxious about the whole thing and they feel like if I start reading, I'm just going to melt into this anxious puddle and not be able to do anything. So it's really important that even in youth circles, we're accepting new people and we are educating without discouraging people or making them feel like they should know this already because we're growing up in the climate crisis. We want to welcome everyone, and it's all right if a youth isn't totally educated on the subject, because they'll have their community around them to support them and take them along with them until they get to the level of education that everyone else is on. So I think that that's another really important thing to remember, that you don't have to know everything. And the youth, we don't know everything, but we are passionate enough to sort of make up for it until we get educated enough, and that that education comes during the process of advocacy and during the process of activism. So, yeah, I've heard a couple people mention that as sort of a counter idea, but I think it all just ties back into, you know, place-based advocacy, community, and collective action and supporting one another.
Yeah, I think that really speaks to just the fact that education, whether that's formal schooling or whether that's just in the community, in living in the community and taking on participating in community initiatives, that's where youth are learning these things, mm-hmm. right? So if there's more support, like in all kinds of whatever, you know, field or topic it is, whenever youth are given the space and the tools and the support that they actually need, which is not something that schools typically give, when they have what they need to actually do the work, they surpass all expectations. They do incredible work that is on par with what adults are doing in the community. There's so many examples of that. And just if we could do that on a greater scale, it just shows all of the potential that youth have to be leaders and decision makers in their communities, because they are their communities just as much as anybody else's, if not more, because they have more years to spend in those communities. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that you said there in terms of, you know, the climate anxiety, I mean, that could be a whole discussion in of itself, yeah. because there's a lot of nuance to that to unpack. But one thing about working on, you know, the local level on initiatives in place, the importance of place, is the hope factor. Working on local initiatives in your own community and working with peers and community members in the places that you live, whether that's like your literally your street or your neighborhood, or whether that's on the city or the county level, doing this work in and with the place and the people that you live with has much more tangible results. It's actually getting your hands, you know, working, actually doing the work on the ground to mm-hmm. build the community and build the places that, you know, everybody's going to be sharing for years to come, and making those decisions to create that future, which is so empowering, right? Obviously, like we said towards the beginning, you know, learning about the international impacts, whether that's the Amazon or whether that's flooding in the global south, whatever it is, melting Arctic ice, whatever it is, it's distant and it can feel hard to actually do anything. And, you know, signing petitions just isn't mm-hmm. cutting it. That's not the level of impact that we want. But doing things on our local level in our own communities, we can actually see the change. We can actually see the impact of those projects that we're doing. And so do other community members, right? Our peers, other community members, you know, local politicians, parents, neighbors, whoever, can also see that impact and maybe even collaborate on the project to bring about that impact. So it facilitates a greater sense of belonging and community cohesion, so that we actually feel a better social support network, which mm-hmm. obviously helps with the anxiety. It's like, hey, we're all working together to do something. That is going to foster so much more hope than just signing petition or retweeting things or, you know, going to, you know, as absolutely crucial as things like marches and protests are, those are, you know, one-time things, whereas, you know, community projects can be, you know, year-long initiatives. They can be continuous. Mm-hmm. There's always things to work on. So just getting in there and literally creating the world that we're going to live in. And that also, another point of that is that localized projects like that, every place has their own unique context, their own local histories, their own yeah. demographic makeup, their own factors, their own, you know, industries, you know, their own population that makes that place unique. So all these solutions are, you know, any solutions we see on, you know, national level or whatever, aren't just universally applicable to all scenarios. They need to be built from the community for that community. And I think that is something we're seeing more with youth, because I think youth recognize that more than a lot of adults do, who are more concerned about the big, you know, policies and things like that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with what you're saying. And, you know, just getting involved in your local politics, especially on a climate level, is so crucial because, you know, if you look at the research that Diane Sachs has done and other environmentalists and ex-environmentalists, people who held environmentalist positions with our past governments, etc., they have sort of come to the conclusion that municipal governments and small communities, through their transportation, through their planning, through their energy usage, and just in their small community-based planning, they can have up to 50% of the deciding power and the impact on greenhouse gas emissions. So communities that work towards decreasing their sprawl, setting firm urban boundaries, protecting their heritage sites and farmland and local water sources, who work towards sustainable transportation and providing even affordable housing, efficient housing, things like that. Those all contribute to decreasing greenhouse gas emissions and bettering the climate. And so that's why place-based advocacy and community action is so important on a climate level. Because if the federal government implements a policy and they decide something, it takes forever to trickle down into the small communities, if it ever does. And even then, the impact is not as large as it would be on a federal level. So that is why municipal decision making is so important if we want to build a more sustainable future. And again, that's why community projects that work to create a more sustainable community, if all the small communities are working on that, we can have such a huge impact.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You know, we talked about, you know, empowering community level action because, you know, it fosters hope and it's richer learning and all of this. But yeah, the other side of that is, yeah, local politics, as you said, our municipal governments, you know, whether that's the city or the county or the township, actually control a lot of the policies that have big impacts on climate action. You know, like emissions, like you said, emissions mm-hmm. reductions. A lot of it's dictated by the provincial government. And obviously with the current provincial government, that means finding more ways, you know, to make profit for companies, regardless of the actual cost of things that the rest of us are going to live with. But municipalities actually get to decide a lot of important things. There's a lot of decision-making power there.
A lot more than
you
think.
For example, you know, we know that in Ontario, transportation is our largest source of emissions. So that's delivery vehicles like food delivery and shopping online like Amazon. That's our personal cars and trucks and government and commercial fleets. It's all of these cars. But local governments can do a lot to actually address that, making local governments actually really indispensable in meeting our 2030 and 2050 climate targets. There's a lot that can be done just in terms of local planning to drastically reduce our emissions and protect our environment, you know, the land that we have left, and to address all of these things. So getting involved on the local level has an equal impact, if not more, compared to pushing for provincial and federal policies, which is also essential. But we can't leave out the local level work as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely agree with everything. I think that it's so important to have youth voices, to have collective action, to have place-based initiatives to create the largest impact possible. And like you said, meet our climate targets.
So I think we're coming up on our time here. There's so much more to talk about in terms of the local politics and local planning and the impact of that, that we've started talking about. But we're actually going to be talking a bit more about that next month. So you'll have to stay tuned for August's episode.
Yes.
If you want to hear more from Blythe or myself, check out our blog posts on SCGC's website, where we chat about various issues impacting youth and youth advocates in Simcoe County. We've also just launched a Youth Vision of Simcoe County survey in partnership with Simcoe County Environmental Youth Alliance, or SEIA. So you can find that on our website or Instagram as well. Anyone 25 and under who lives in Simcoe County, fill that out and tell us what you want for the future of your community.
Yeah, and even if you're listening to this and you're over 25, send it to all the youth in your life. Send it to everyone you know. Just get the word out, because it's so important that people have a say in what they want the future of their community to look like. And Kelly's made a really great survey that's so simple. You can just fill it out and sort of explain your vision for Simcoe County, which I think is really cool. And then as well, stay tuned for some more of the Simcoe County Greenbelt Coalition's youth advocacy initiatives, like an upcoming toolkit that will provide resources for youth advocates to start making their voices heard on a political level.
Absolutely. It's going to be fantastic. With that, I think we will bid you all farewell and see you next month.
Yeah. Hope you enjoyed.
So again, I'm Kelly and
I'm Blythe.
And we'll see you next month.